isn't just a stone wall. You're not using your brain. That's what the white man wants you to do. Look at you. What makes you ashamed of being black?
Number love for you. I know how hard it is. No doubt. Being a woman, a black woman at that.
Peace.
In this white man's world, sometimes we overlook the fact that we can ride hard in our system. We won't be knowing the pain we can cause. In this white man's world, this white man's world. I ain't saying I'm innocent at all.
This says Views on the 7 podcast. Peace to Park.
Yeah.
Dear sister, got me twisted up in prison. I miss you. Crying, looking at my nieces and my nephew's picture. They say don't let this cruel world get you.
Kind of suspicious.
Swear one day you might leave me
for somebody that's rich.
Twist the cap off the bottom. I take a sip and see tomorrow. Gotta make it
if I had to beg a buck.
Love letters late night. Locked down and quiet. Your brothers don't receive their mail.
Best believe we ride.
Eating Jack Matt, staring at the walls of silence inside this cage when it captured all my rage and violence. In time I learned a few lessons, never fall for riches. Apologies to my true sisters, far from bitches. Help me raise my black nation, reparations to do. It's true, caught up in this world, I took advantage of you. So tell the baby.
This is the Views from the 7 podcast.
Girls, born black, in this white man's
we ain't finished.
DJ Chicago Kid, I need you to not touch this.
All these motherfuckers want to be like us. They all want to be like us. To be the have-nots. All here. God bless the shadow. Can hold his own. No motherfucking doubt. Being born with less, I must confess. Only adds on to the stress. Two gunshots to my homie's head. Die in his vest.
Oh, man. Peace, y'all. This is the Views from the 7 podcast. Bonus, 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 bonus. This you guys spend some joint with my homeboy Skinny.
Yay, yay.
Ivan.
AKA Positive Pete.
And
what's happening?
What's up, y'all? If y'all can't tell, man, I'm feeling good today, man. I'm feeling real fucking good today. It's been
in a good mood.
Yeah, man. Hey, I've been putting in mad work.
A lot of sleep.
I've been putting in mad work. Man, it's been 2 years since I was able to fit in this shirt, baby. And my body is in it. That's work, baby. I'm working.
Keep working. Keep working. I see you.
Well, what's up with y'all, fellas?
Not really fitting yet, but.
Gotcha. Wow. Oh, shit.
Cool. That's cool.
Just because you built like Captain America before the serum.
Before the serum?
Steve Rogers.
What's up, fellas? How y'all doing, man? Not about your weekends or nothing. Just how y'all doing mentally? What's up?
I'm good, man.
I'm in a good space.
You always good. I shouldn't even ask you.
I'm in a good space. I'm in a good space.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I see you, man. Broke out the slides again.
You already know.
Day Beach. You going to a Day Beach after this?
I'm already there. Yeah. I mean, I seen that Corona commercial. You ain't got to tell me where my beach at no more.
Okay. Yeah. All right, man. Without further ado, y'all. I told you, man, we wasn't going to let our foot off the gas. We wasn't going to let the things that's happening in our community go to waste. We're not going to get over it. Today, man, we have a special brother, man, an elder. He is one of the founders of the Las Vegas and Houston chapters of the People's Party. And, man, we're going to get into it, man. We're going to get into a bunch of stuff. Things that's still going on in our community today, and we're gonna keep them fresh. I think it's important, man, that we start with our elders and work our way up.
Down.
Is it down?
Yeah.
No, because our elders are the foundation.
Okay. Facts.
Gotcha.
That's down.
So that's up. So we're gonna work our way up, like you say.
Gotcha.
Yeah, man. God, see. I'm not getting my English from Skinny, dude. I'm not.
I'm glad Ant understood you.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting you to, bro. I ain't even gonna lie to you. All right, without further ado.
All right, what's going on, my brother?
Brother Creer, how you doing? This is
doing all right.
You are live on the Views from the 7 podcast. How you doing, my brother?
Doing good. Just sitting there on a Sunday chilling. Glad to be here.
I hear you. Any guys, fellas, y'all want to start? First and foremost, we want to say thank you. We really want to say thank you for this opportunity to, man, just dig in your brain, man, get as much knowledge as we can, as they say.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it. When you think about it, I appreciate it because it's important to me and my comrades. I mean, we're still here, but we're losing comrades every year left and right. So it's important for the legacy of the Black Panther Party to live on. And it's 55 years later, and it's living on. A lot of youth, you know, look toward the party and stuff. So I appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Before we even get into the legacy and the history of the Black Panther Party, how are you doing mentally? You know, this is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Carl Hampton. With so many of your comrades being assassinated and being in prison, how do you deal with it all?
Well, you know, the thing about it is that you continue the struggle and continue being a servant of people. You know, I mean, many of my comrades, with myself, we still participate and pushing and fighting, and we might not be able to do the things that we did when we were younger, because as E.P. Newton said, you know, the youth is the future of the revolution. But the thing about it, I'm so proud of these young brothers and sisters now that's been in the streets for 20 days straight. It brings a smile to my face, you know. In fact, I was talking to my comrades the other day, and she said it brings tears to her eyes because of all the things that we went through. And to get to this point, and it's not the end, because the struggle is protracted. It's not, and partly we should say that, it's not, you don't go from A to Z. Everything is A, B, C, D. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I'm very proud of young folks out there in the street. And then, like I said, it brings a smile to my face.
Ooh. So starting off, your beginning, how did you find your way into the struggle?
Well, you know, the thing about it is... believe it or not, from my parents and the community I grew up in. You know, I grew up with my father, in fact, Dr. Clear, practiced medicine in Las Vegas, and my mother, Dorothy Clear. I mean, I grew up on stories of the Depression. I mean, my mother talking about how when a neighbor needed, didn't have anything, and they might only had a cup of beans, they'd split it with them, you know, and how the community would come together. I mean, the first time I saw my daddy cry was when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And he, he wasn't booing, but he had tears in his eyes, and he kept saying, why did they kill him? He kept saying, that man ain't never done nothing to nobody.
Yeah.
You know, why did they kill him? So, it's like Prince's song, The Sign of the Times. You know, I grew up, I was born in 1952. You know, I grew up when seeing police with dogs, and I ain't talking about as demonstrations, I'm talking about in the street as a kid. You know, and them sticking dogs on people, you know, and all the police were white. And so I said, The Sign of the Times, and growing up watching the whole civil rights movement. You know, and cause that's the thing with TV right now. Now it's social media.
Yeah.
But back then, you know, TV was, you know, of course it was black and white, but it's something that you saw.
You said the newspaper. Relax.
People getting beat, or you saw the Vietnam War in actual time, you know, so it had a huge impact.
Mm. So back then, the majority of you guys' information was through the newspaper and television, correct?
Yeah. Newspaper. Now, like I said, you had TV. You had Walter Cronkite, who was one of the because Walter Cronkite was the first one told the truth about what was happening in Vietnam. You know, because American people were being told how, you know, we were kicking ass.
Yeah.
And Walter Cronkite went over there, and he came back and he said that we losing the war. You know what I mean? And plus, not only losing the war, what are we fighting for? You know what I mean?
Mm, so he was the first one to tell the truth on television.
Right.
Mm. So with the, because you grew up in, you say 59?
52.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
I was born in 52. Yeah, I was born
from 52. So you,
1952.
Ooh, yeah. You, that was right in the middle of the craziness.
Yeah.
And so
then my family moved to L.A. in 1960. My father went to middle school in Los Angeles.
So you witnessed it all.
So we moved to L.A. And I tell you the thing about community, even back then, they used to have a Griffith Park in L.A., which is a big, big, big place. But every summer, they used to have a picnic called the Houstonian.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be thousands of people that either were in L.A. Because, you know, the migration during World War II, most of the blacks that came to California from Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas. And so they would have this Houstonian picnic. So it would be thousands of people. It'd be people that were living in L.A., and their families would come in from Houston, and it was a big celebration. People from Houston would bring, like newspaper, one of the black newspapers here is called the Four Times, which is still being published. And people would bring the Four Times so people could see news about what was happening in the black community in Houston. So like I say, the sign of the time, and people were, you know, it was... Family was very important,
yes.
You know, back in the 50s and the 60s.
So how did you guys throughout, how much of a part did these huge assassinations play in the making of who you are? You know, the Martins, the Malcolms, very prominent figures in our community, even abroad, just assassinated.
Yeah.
So how?
You know, the thing about Malcolm, you know, and I want to say this, that, like I say, just like the news media is now, so some call them fake news, but even back then, what I want to say before I talk about Malcolm,
yeah,
it's like when you watched on TV and they would say that, they didn't say the Nation of Islam, they would say the black Muslims. It was like to put fear in people's hearts, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
They have Malcolm talking about the devil and the white folks and stuff like that. But, you know, when Malcolm was assassinated, then everybody in my generation, you read the autobiography of Malcolm X, you know, by Axe Haley. And Motown put out a LP. A lot of people don't know what an LP is, but it was an album. And it was his speeches. And so it inspired our generation. Now, the Black Panther Party, we consider ourselves the heirs of Malcolm X.
Mm.
That we were his children. He talked about the battle and the bullet, because he had to remember the party. For one thing, the Black Panther Party, when it started, was called the Black Panther Party of Self-Defense.
Absolutely.
Because we were dealing with the same issues that we're dealing with now. I mean, it was worse now. I mean, and... So, because we said we had a right that black people, all people, had a right to defend yourself, defend your home, defend your family. But also, we believed in, like Malcolm said, the ballot or the bullet, that you still had to use political power because, you know, that's how it was available then and it's available now.
Yes. Mm. So you are a proponent of... voting and involving yourself in the political system.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just like Elders Cleaver ran for president on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. You know, Bobby Seale ran for mayor, and Elaine Brown ran for city council, and we scared the mess out of the folks that was open because the mayor at that time had been in office 14 years and had never, ever been in a runoff. Mm-hmm. And we forced a runoff. We got 43% of the vote.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And we got 43% of the vote. But we had a well-oiled machine. And like I said, he had never done it. So you have to use all tools and all people because it's a place for everybody in the struggle, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, just like in any revolution, it's people that was financing that stuff, whether it was Fidel in Cuba or, yeah. You know. So, you know, everybody has a place. You know, we have so many people that, well, you know, they'll get down on this brother, this sister, because they don't think they're down enough or whatever, but everybody got a place.
So do you believe in the quote-unquote white allies? And how do we correctly use them, and how can they use their position of power?
Well, you know, the thing about it is just like, for one thing, you'll have different stories about the Black Panther Party and it says the Civil Rights Organization. No, we wasn't the Civil Rights Organization. I mean, civil rights struggle was necessary, but civil was law. Mm. I mean, and the thing about it was the laws was already in the book, but you had all these states' right people saying they wasn't going to follow the federal law.
Yeah.
That's why they sent in federal troops, you know what I mean, to integrate the colleges or whatever. Mm. The laws was already in the book. So that, but we were a human rights organization. We believe in everybody has a right to decent housing, everybody has a right to full employment, health care, all that stuff. And on the issue of, you have to remember that we didn't say black power. We said all power to the people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was a slogan that was chanted around the world and still chanted around the world. That the first Rainbow Coalition wasn't created by Jesse Jackson. It was created by Fred Hampton in Chicago.
Yep.
When he brought together the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords, which was a Puerto Rican organization, and Young Patriots was a white organization. He used to call them hillbillies, because they all came from just like we migrated from the South. There's a lot of poor white people migrated from the South to the North, and Fred and the comrades went to them and said, hey, man, y'all got the same problem we got. The police fuck with y'all. You know, you don't have decent jobs. Mm. So that was the first Rainbow Coalition. So we had a lot of correlations with different white organizations. The thing about it was you couldn't join the Black Panther Party because, like we said, we said all power to people, but we said we're talking about black people in particular.
Yep.
And all oppressed people, but the reason we said that because we said that we have to show our community that we, as black people, can do stuff for ourselves.
Yeah.
And we had all kind of coalitions, but there was a White Panther Party. You know, we had all kind of coalitions with different organizations. We were very, very, very strong supporters of C.J. Vance and the farm workers when they boycotted Safeway, and the grapes, and the lettuce. In fact, I met Caesar Bears very, very. So we were very strong in supporting them.
Yeah.
You know, so we believe, it's like Bobby Seale would say, I don't care if you're black, white, brown, red, polka dot, whatever, you know, because you have to understand white supremacy, and that's what I tell a lot of our brothers and sisters,
yeah,
is that, you know, we talk about how bad we've been done. white supremacy is worldwide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, worldwide.
Yeah.
They stole from people of color around the world.
Mm.
You know, so I mean, we're not the only ones. These people on Facebook, they was arguing about who was done worse, the Native Americans, the Indian people, or black people.
Yeah.
What kind of crap to say? You know, who was done worse? I mean, we all, you know, was messed over by it, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, so that's our point.
Yeah.
That we got to have a united front. Because I'll tell you something, this is what I tell people even, you know, because white folks ain't going nowhere. Black folks, we ain't going nowhere. Brown folks ain't going nowhere. Gays ain't going nowhere, you know. So we got to come together with a united strategy to fight the common enemy.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I ain't going to lie to you, brother. The White Panther Party sounds very uncomfortable. So, coming up in your heyday, who are some of the ancestors that you look to?
Oh, wow, man. Of course, Stokely, Kwame Ture.
Mm.
You know, Malcolm, Martin, and it's a shame, just like even today, that, you know, we don't educate them, because I knew nothing of Marcus Garvey as a kid or as a teenager, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Until I started studying about, studying about our history.
Mm-hmm.
And, but of course, you know, I knew about Nat Turner, and, you know, so, I mean, that's the thing, is so many people, I mean, just like my father's generation and the generation before him, people think that, you know, well, they've cowed down to, it's just like when the movie Roots came out and I was in high school. You know, you had people telling me, man, if I lived in that time, they wouldn't have treated me like that. Nigga bullshit. you probably the first motherfucking town, oh, master, please don't hit me again. You know, my point is, those generations, we've been fighting for a long time, and we fought in subtle ways. You know what I'm saying? And my father, like I said, became a doctor. I remember my father tell me, don't never trust a white person. He told me that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But, you know, the thing about systematic racism, now, my grandmother, on my father's side, I got a twin sister. Mm. So when we were born, she wanted a white doctor to deliver us. Now, here's her son going to school to be a doctor, and she wanted a white doctor to deliver us. So let's show you how ingrained, you know, these folks was in our mind.
Yeah. Mm.
And then when, like I said, back then, they didn't have ultrasound. And so my sister was born first, and when they came out and said it was a girl, she was upset. Because, you know, back then, you know, boys or men was, you know, especially you come in, she was a teacher here in Houston, but they came from Bryan, Texas, you know, farming, you know, farmers wanted a boy to help work the fields, you know what I'm saying? And then when I was, in fact, they said, when they said it was a girl, she started hitting the doctor in the chest.
Damn.
And So they came back out 15 minutes later, so it's a boy, and then she hugged the doctor. You know?
Wow.
So that's the mentality that we have to come from, you know. And like a lot of people say, ain't no progress been made, but there's been progress just in our mindset of who we are as a people, you know. And so, I mean, just like back then, everybody had what they called a conch, you know.
Mm.
I'm talking about men, you know, where they would either use an iron to straighten the hair, or put the conquered are using that lye.
Yeah.
To straighten their hair, like James Brown back in when he first, you know what I'm saying?
Yep. Yeah.
And or put the root, the woman put the rouge on to lighten they skin, mm. or make it look light, not lighten their skin, but it look lighter. Wow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was the mindset that we were in and that we've come from, you know?
Mm. So was your do you trust white people at all?
Oh, well, some. I've got some. It's a sister here named, and she's white. I call her my sister. Her name is Gloria Rubeck. She's, she's been in the Workers' World Party for years, but and she's also head of the Bodies of Death Penalty organizations here. But she was down there when Carl Hampton, I don't know how long we've been knowing since, she was down there when Carl Hampton was assassinated.
Oh, wow.
You know? Mm. So, yeah, it's a lot of people that's down now. It's you know, it's the same thing. There's a lot of black folks I don't trust. You know what I'm saying?
Mm, yeah.
You know, it's a lot of black. I tell you what, I ask people from different organizations. They talk about, have you ever been to the bottom? When I say the bottom, I'm talking about the lowest of the low in the black community. And a lot of people won't even go down there. And you're supposed to be down with the revolution and all that shit. Mm. You know what I mean? Have you ever been to the bottom? You know. And so there's a lot of black people I don't trust.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm. This is Ivan, man. I had a question, but first and foremost, I want to say thank you for all the work you put in, you know, on the ground, because you know.
Well, I appreciate
needed.
That.
Much needed.
But you know, I want to say thank you to y'all, because it's just like a lot of times I meet young people, and they'll tell me the same thing. And it's an honor to meet me and that kind of stuff. And I tell them, it's an honor to meet them because they continue to struggle. Mm. And if it wasn't for them, then everything that we did would have been for nothing.
Mm.
I remember back in October, we had a program in Oakland for the 50th anniversary of the start of the Free Breakfast Program. Mm. And there was a young sister, She was going to UC Berkeley. She was from Alabama, and she came up to me, and she had tears in her eyes, and she said, "Oh, thank you, Father." And she always had me crying, you know. But like I told her, and I told her, "Thank you, because it wasn't y'all keeping the legacy alive and keep organizing, because it's protracted struggle." You know, like I said earlier, you know, it don't go from A to Z. It's something we got to push. Some people, yep. Especially a lot of young people, get frustrated and, you know, well, we ain't made no progress. And, no, but it's a protracted struggle. I mean, just like, and you can come back to your question, but it's just like with the Cuban Revolution. I mean, Fidel Castro had his little band and they attacked the army barracks. They got arrested. He served 2 years in prison, got out, went over to Mexico. That was a defeat. That was a setback. Went over to Mexico, met Che, put together, and then the rest is history. So you're going to have defeats. You know, it's just like a lot of these Bernie supporters. You know, hey, it's a setback. But Trump got to go, man. He got to go.
Yeah.
I mean, he has already appointed 2 Supreme Court justices. They've appointed 57 federal judges, and all these are lifetime positions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell and Graham are going around right now trying to get older justices to retire so they could appoint them before the election, because they fear they're going to lose the election. Mm-hmm. You know, he got to go, man. And people don't think about it, man. It's, I mean, take a lump, you got to defeat, but we got to get him out of there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a question for you. You talking about Trump, and I know earlier in the podcast you were talking about, you alluded to like the fake news situation and how they described you guys.
Right.
When I read on what you guys were doing, it was like, you know, the sickle cell program, the free breakfast. I heard you talk about the transportation situation with the seniors. So, like, for me, right. When I read about these things, I hear, or I read, this is a community organization for the people. you know, but you guys are often right. You guys are often described as a militant group. Does that categorization ever bother you, or do you feel like it's accurate, or do you feel like, how do you feel about being called a militant group?
Well, you know, the things about the programs, it saved the party, because like I said, we were portrayed in the news media and by the government as these thugs and gangsters and stuff like that. And it's like when people would meet you through the programs, they said, wait a minute, he's just like my son and my daughter. In fact, when I remember the Houston Post came over in the Fourth Ward where we had an office, and they interviewed all these senior citizens, and they were like, man, these young brothers and sisters are angels sent from heaven. You know, they look out for us, the seniors, they feed our kids. And then to me, one of the most important programs that we did was the sickle cell anemia testing program. Mm-hmm. You know, because sickle cell, because see, the thing about it is you cannot tell you got sickle cell just from going to the doctor and just getting a regular blood test. It's a whole different test that you have to get. I guess it's like the the virus thing. But I remember our poster, you know, we had a poster of this young brother, he's probably about 8 years old, that was for our sickle cell program. And his story was that the sickle cell, the red blood cells, some are curved like a sickle, and they clog up in the joints, elbow, knees. And he would be complaining about pain, bad pain. His mama took him to a couple of doctors, and they couldn't find him. And she said she used to spank him because she said he was lying, because the doctor said there wasn't nothing wrong with him. Mm. And then when we started probing, she took him, and he got tested for sickle. He had sickle cell anemia. You know, I remember there's a high school here called Wheatley High School, and the principal, he used to call us his sons and daughters. He used to let us come on campus and sell papers. And then some classrooms we go to speak, and I remember this teacher asking me who was the first organization in the country that started testing for sickle cell. I said, the Black Panther Party. She said, but the only reason I said that is because I'm from Detroit. And she said, my sister has sickle cell, and she never would have known it if it wasn't for the Black Panther Party. Hmm. So, I mean, just like the Tuskegee syphilis thing. The Black Panther Party exposed that whole thing in our newspaper. You know, it wasn't fake news. Mm. We put everything out there, you know. So it was, many things. Like you said, the seniors program, we call it the SAFE program, the seniors for safe environment. We would go and pick up seniors and take them to cash their Social Security checks, take them to the store, take them to medical things. So everybody knows about the breakfast program. They know, and the free medical clinics, you know, because that's why I said we were a human rights organization. We wanted the civil rights organization. That's what Malcolm talked about, was human rights. Mm, yeah. You know, that was the difference between him and King, you know. And then the thing about King, too, they say they don't talk about the radical King.
Yeah.
Because when King started talking about the military industrial complex, when he started talking about the Vietnam War, and when he started talking about capitalism, well, he was a threat.
Yeah.
You know, he always had a large following. He had to go. He was a threat. You know, but they don't want to talk. All they want to talk about is, I have a dream, King. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, they don't want to talk about the radical. So this is Skinny. You just spoke on sickle cell and the COVID-19. And I read that. The sickle cell was mainly targeted towards the African Americans. What?
Right.
So, do you feel like that the government tried to target the COVID-19 to the African Americans as well? Like,
no, I don't think so. I mean, you got to look at the conspiracies out there, but I don't think so. I think, you know, and I hate to say this. And it breaks my heart when I go to the grocery store, I see so many obese people in our community, you know, and not people just fat, I mean obese. And I think that's, I'm seriously, I mean, that's part of the problem, you know, it's like my neighbor that used to live upstairs. I mean, she weighed 380 pounds.
Sheesh.
You know, and she was constantly going to the doctor. And I said, if you lose weight, you know what I mean? All that, you know, all my knees hurt. I used to tell her, I said, your knees probably hate when you get up and walk. Please, you know. But I mean, seriously, if you look at, especially in the South, fried foods, sugar. If you come to the South, if you want sweet tea, you're going to get sweet tea.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, people in the South put sugar on everything. Black people in the South. Spaghetti, of course, grits. Everything. You know, and salt. You know? You know, the thing about with me is like, when a person gets high blood pressure, the doctor tell you to cut back on salt, stop using salt. Well, why wait to get to that point? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like they talk about preventative medicine. Why wait to get to that point? Because both of those white things there, sugar and salt, they kill us. Mm. You know, and there's people walking around not even just obese, but they got high blood pressure or diabetes because of all that salt and sugar. You know?
Yeah. Okay.
And pork. You know, and pork. Don't let me leave that out.
All right, hey brother, this is Ant. I want to ask you, I'm going to go back just a tad bit really quick to the organization. You guys are one of the most well-organized, you know, organizations we've ever seen on so many different fronts, you know.
Right.
Was there an organization before you guys that we don't know about that you guys modeled this after, or was this just a result of young, brilliant minds coming together, brainstorming, and tossing out ideas?
The thing about it is it's just like, you know, Roy Williams, you know, who picked up arms, and you had the Diggins of Defense that picked up arms. And, you know, just like the brothers in Lyles County, you know, they had the Panther. In fact, Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton got in touch with them and asked them if they could use a panther as a symbol of their organization, you know. And so, like I said, it's time time. But you have to think about it, too, is that when Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton started the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, they didn't think it was going to go international, you know. It was just a community base. We're going to patrol the police.
Yeah.
You know, and they patrolled the police with weapons, and they carried a law book and cameras and tape recorder. And then it went national, for one thing, when Bobby Seale and the Comrades went to the courthouse. Because, you know, the legislators wanted to pass this law called the Mumford Bill, which they did pass, saying it was against the law to carry loaded weapons in the street.
Yeah.
Now where was the NRA then?
Yeah.
It was just but the black folks. And that went, man, that went, I mean, I got comrades that I met, you know, and I was younger than, but I got comrades. That was one of the reasons they joined the party.
Yeah.
You know, because of, the first chapter was the Sacramento chapter. His brother named Charles Bronson. And he saw that, and he came to Oakland, and he already had his little group together. And you had L.A., and the first chapter outside of the state of California was the Seattle chapter, was founded by Aaron Dixon and his brother Elmer Dixon. Mm. And then you had the incident with Huey P. Newton, where he was accused of killing a policeman and one of the other ones. Well, of course, it went worldwide. Free Huey movement went worldwide. So that took the party from just a community-based thing in Oakland to a worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's people, it's just like, you know, it's like the whole African race. I mean, it's people from Angola and Mozambique that was fighting. And they said they took the example from the Black Panther Party, you know. it's a group here that has a thing on Angola Little Racing Day every year. They invite me to the thing. It's a big dinner and banquet and stuff. But like I said, because they took example from the Black Panther Party to stand up and, you know. So it became a worldwide phenomenon. But like I said, it just started as a local community organization.
Yeah.
Off topic for a quick minute, and I don't want to dive too much into this, but it was interesting to me because Kwanzaa is a huge holiday, and I know the conflict between the Black Panther Party and Ron Coringa. Is that something you celebrate?
No, I don't really. Now I'll go to Kwanzaa celebration here, but no, I don't celebrate. I'll go just to support my. Just like one of my best friends, and he's over here almost every day, Kobe Tahaka. He's a NASA chairman of the NASA Black United Front.
Yeah.
You know, which is a Black NASA organization. And, you know, we talk so. But I go to support, or another one of my good friends is Abdul Halim, who's the minister of the mosque here in Houston. And so I go to support them, but no, I don't, you know, because for one thing, it's not just a beef, but Ron Kling and his organization killed four party members.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Everybody knows about Princess Bunchy Carter and John Huggins in L.A., but they also killed two members of the party in San Diego, you know. Mm. So, I mean, that's blood. I mean, And I don't celebrate Kwanzaa.
Okay.
You know, like I show up just to, because I'm known in the community here, and then a lot of people, I show up just to, you know.
Yeah, support.
Support them, but I don't celebrate Kwanzaa.
Okay. For those, because we are real connected to the youth in our community, and for those who this sparks their interest on a major level, the Panthers that, you know, we've come to know, the Eldridge Cleavers, the Fred Hamptons, Huey P. Newtons, Bobby Seals, what Panther members did you work with that were very prominent in what we've come to know? Mm. Are the leaders that should be highlighted?
Well, I used to be a Bobby Seals aide, and when I say that, he called it aid, but I was his bodyguard. I stayed in the same house with him. We were together all day, you know, traveling. Anytime he went somewhere outside the city, you know, as far as, I remember we went to D.C. for this, it was a meeting on the census.
Yeah.
Because, you know, all the Black organizations say it was an undercount. And, you know, I traveled there, you know, traveled. Anytime he went out of town, I traveled with him. And I worked real close with Lee Lane, and I knew Huey. You know, I drove Huey a few times, but I had contact with him quite a few times. You know, Huey was very, he was a genius. He was, you know, he, all of them were sharp.
Yes.
Mm. You know, like, you know, Lane. And see, the thing about it is like, Huey and Bobby was more so somebody who spoke at rallies or stuff like that, because he could break it down where people understood it. Because that's the whole thing, you know. Just like I was at a meeting here a while back with these young brothers, and they all philosophizing and all this stuff. And like I told them, you know, y'all are all smart, but you can't take that people to the people. You got to bring it down to the people's level.
Yep. Mm.
Where they understand. And that's what Bobby could do. You know, he'd break it down to where a person like Huey was at a whole another level because he was a theoretician. I mean, so, you know, he might talk to people and be like, what the hell is that nigga saying? Shit. and then Lane, I worked with Lane a little close. You know, I hadn't seen any Lane Brown since probably 1978, and she came to Houston maybe about 4 years ago to speak. Mm. And in fact, she came in to Vegas. We had a function in Vegas. But anyway, so I hadn't seen her since 1978. So when I walked up to her, and she's like, "Oh, a bunch." She said, "Man, we went to hell and back together." I said, "Yeah, we did." Cause that's the thing about it. People want to fantasize about the party and, you know, do kind of other stuff, but it was real. I mean, we lost 32 comrades. Wow. I mean, dead. Mm-hmm. You know, we still got people in prison right now, like Mamouya.
Yep.
So, you know, it was real. There wasn't no. I mean, you had to be dedicated. You had to be serious. I mean, there's a lot of people. I call them in and outers. You know, they join the party one minute. Then once they saw it was hard work, or that you again would be harassed by the police every day, they wasn't around no more, you know. And so, yeah, it was serious. It wasn't no fantasy. It wasn't no, you know. It was serious. It was hard work because, I mean, just like that Central Branch program, you had to work up 4:30 in the morning, go. Prepare the meals for the kids. Then you had to clean up. Then you had to go out in the field. And when I say out in the field, either you had to go take 100 papers out there and sell them, because everybody that sold papers, we got a brown paper grocery bag filled with 100 papers. Mm. So you go out and sell them, or you went out and collected donations, or everybody had what we call that the field. Everybody had a function, you know. And then when you came home, I mean, you know, we studied. You had to come home, you read from the Planthenon or, you know, Malcolm or Kwame Nkrumah. You know, it wasn't, you know. And then, in every facility in the Black Panther Party, we didn't have the office, or every facility we had, there was somebody always awake. 24 hours of the day, 7 days of the week. So everybody took shifts. So you don't work hard all day, and then you take a 3-hour shift, and you go tap your comrade, "Hey, man, it's your turn." And they had to get up and take their 3-hour shift. So it wasn't no play thing. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I had a question about the incident specifically and the effects afterwards. So I was reading that Duncan Tell, I don't want to slander his first name, but Duncan Tell basically told the Houston police to, you know, stay away from the party headquarters. And from what I can understand of it, the police took it as kind of like, you know, you guys, we're the police and we can go where we want to go. And that kind of, to me, seemed like it led to the incident where the brother Hampton was assassinated. My question to you is...
Now, okay, go ahead, finish your question.
Okay, my question was, you know, without Duncan Tell saying what he said to the police, do you feel like maybe this confrontation could have been avoided, or was this inevitable at some point because of
No, well, see, Duncan Tell really wasn't, and Duncan was a good brother, but no, that wasn't going to be avoided. And see, what Duncan Tell said, and, you know, part of him was kind of upset because he made a statement that for every black person was killed, that they was gonna kill 10 police, you know. Mm. And we were like, shit, they ain't gonna come after you. They gonna come after us. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You know, he just talking, you know. So the situation with Carl, what had happened was that his brother selling papers, the Panther paper, because see, People's Party too. Let me tell you about Carl first. Carl Hampton, he was a musician. And so he was with this band. They traveled the country. So when they got to Oakland, that's when he came in contact with the Black Panther Party. Mm. And so the time that they were there, he did community work with the party. And so when he got ready to leave to come back to Houston, he had asked them, could he start a chapter of the Black Panther Party in Houston? And he was told no, because at that time, the party had expanded so fast that they wasn't opening any more chapters.
Okay.
You know, because they had to figure out who everybody was and everything. So Carl came back to Houston, he got a job at Sears, and back during that time, Sears had lunch counters and stuff. So he got a job washing dishes at Sears and raised enough money to get an office, and he started Peter's Party 2. And the reason he called it Peter's Party 2 because he said the Black Panther Party was the Vanguard Party, and that was the number one party. So Peter's Party 2 followed the 10-point platform of the Black Panther Party, rules and regulations, and sold the Black Panther Party newspaper. So it was a brother selling a newspaper by the office, which was on the street called the Dollar at that time. They changed the name to Emancipation. But and Carl pulls up, and the police was talking to this brother that was selling paper. And he had a 45 strapped to his chest. And so he went over and asked the police what was going on, what was the problem. And the police said, well, what are you doing with that gun on your chest? You know, and Carl told him that wasn't none of their business, that he had the right under the law to openly carry a weapon. And so the police started walking toward him. He told them they need to stay back. So the police went for their gun. Carl went for his gun, and he outdrew him. So Carl stayed back. So they called, of course, called backup. But by the time they called backup, people in the community had heard what was going on. They came out and stood in front of the office and said, y'all ain't going to mess with these brothers. Mm-hmm. So for a week, it was almost like what's going on in Seattle right now. From a three-block area, for a week, there's no police. People came from, and now this is when Dunkertail came down. Dunkertail was from Sunnyside. He came down with his little people. Everybody came down with guns from Sunnyside, Pleasantville, North Side, South Side, and so there wasn't no police in that whole area for the, you know, whole week. And so on July 26th, this is 1970, Congress was holding a rally at Emancipation Park, which is right across the street from the office. And these two women came and told Carl there was some white men up on roof of St. John's Church, which is maybe a block away. It's the tallest building in Third Ward. So Carl and this white guy, Barty Hill, he's from the John Brown Association, organization, whatever. They walked down to see what's going on. So it was three police on the roof. It was three snipers, and it was another guy was a reporter. He was the spotter. He had interviewed Carl 3 days before, so he was the one who was going to show him which one was Carl. So when Carl and they walked down the street, it was across the street. When they came across the street, police opened fire. And Barty Hill got shot in the shoulder. They shot Carl. And this sister, the Brave sister, because she wasn't a part of the organization, wasn't part of the struggle, she drove up in her Volkswagen and put Carl in a Volkswagen and drove him to the hospital where he died later. So that's how it happened. Dunkertail didn't have anything to do with starting, you know, the whole thing. But yeah, that's what happened.
Okay. Do you feel like the parties, the People's Party 2, the movement died a little bit once Brother Hampton was assassinated? Like, how did things proceed going forward after that?
Oh, no, it got stronger. I mean, my comrade James Ann, he became the chairman and proceeded, and we moved into a new building in the middle of the street. We still had the first building was on the corner, and that was going to be, I tell you, Congressman Nicky Leland was a huge supporter of People's Party 2, and him and Carl were good friends. In fact, the night Carl got killed, he came down as he was happening. He got arrested. And, you know, he graduated from Texas Southern University in pharmacy. So the original headquarters was going to be turned into a free health clinic. We moved down about three floors down to a two-story house, and that became the headquarters. New headquarters people are too. And the clinic never got off the ground because the police came by and shot the building up.
Jeez.
And then the health department said it wasn't fit to be, you know, a clinic. But yeah, we had a lot of support, you know. I mean, a lot of support.
So, moving forward, at any point, did you feel like, not internally, I think the struggle never goes away. The feeling to want to fight never goes away. But internally, did you ever get to a point where it was almost you felt like the organization was fighting a losing battle? Because I know, you know, with COINTELPRO and the police, kind of like infiltrating the program, how did you guys hold things steady?
Yeah, you know what? You know, the same thing about it is, I remember if y'all get a chance, and you can get it digitally ordered. There's a book called "On the Ground: The Black Panther Party and Communities Across America," and it's it was put together by Professor Jeffries. He's out of college in Ohio. But first chapter is on. Not the chapter, the first part of the book is on Peace Party 2 in the Houston chapter of Black Panther Party. But that said, you know, just the constant harassment. I mean, just like when my first year when I joined the party, because I first started doing community work in Los Angeles. And this is one thing that made me join the party was I was a freshman in college, and my friends asked me if I'd like to go to a political education class at the Black Panther office.
Yeah.
I said, yes. So I went, and it was very educational, and it was really humbling, because afterwards they asked us who liked to eat. They was going to eat dinner, and I was like, first we refused, but we were like, man, these brothers are struggling, and they... brothers and sisters struggling, I know, and they insisted, you know, for me. So I started going on weekends with a Black Panther Party member named James Palms, and we go downtown Los Angeles and sell the paper. And to show you just mentioned COINTELPRO, the scrutiny that was on the Black Panther Party, I'm 18-year student in college, and my mother comes in my bedroom. She says, "There's two gentlemen from the FBI in the living room. They want to talk to you."
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, "Mama, stop playing." I'm like, "Mama, stop playing with me." She said, "No, I'm serious." You know, so I go up there. Sure enough, and they flash their badges, like, you know. And so they had this big thick book, and so they asked me if I was a member of the Black Panther Party. I told them no. And so, like I said, they had this big book. They opened it up, and they had all these pictures. Well, do you know this person? Do you know that person? Blah, 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 blah. And so we were making a problem. My mother, she stopped them at one point. And she said, "We all asking all these questions." She said, "I got a question for y'all." She said, "J. Edgar Hoover says it's the Black Panther Party is the greatest threat to the security of the United States and the history of the United States." And so she said, "Well, what about the mafia?" And so they said, so they started playing the salt and pepper, you know. So one of them said, "Well, you know, the Panthers, they do a lot of good things. They got a breakfast program and they pre-help communities and stuff." And I'm saying, "Yeah, when they start talking about that violence, see, that's not a thing." But the thing that got me is when they were leaving, really, that's what pushed me over the edge. When they were leaving, they said, "John, you know, you stay in school. When you graduate from school, you get you a good job. You'll never hear from us again." And I'm like, "God damn, these motherfuckers trying to tell me how to live my life. If I walk this straight and narrow path," and you know what I'm saying? And that pushed me over the edge, you know. And, so, yeah, so the threats, it's always, and the reason I mentioned that book is Dr. Jones is wanting to put together this thing apart, and he asked me why I stayed. So I was a member of the party for 10 years. And like I told him, hey, we was at war. You know, I wasn't going to abandon my comrades, you know, because of harassment. I mean, the first year I joined the party right here in Houston, I went to jail 13 times. I talked about this petty stuff.
Oh, damn.
What they would do, they would pull us over for bogus traffic stuff, and then they wouldn't let you sign the ticket until they got you in jail. Then once you're in jail, they let you sign the ticket, but you had to pay to get out. So it was a drain on our funds. Plus, it was trying to mentally break you down. And so, you know, and many times, like I say, went through much worse. You know, like I said, many times was still in prison right now, you know.
Wow. So, how did you make your way to Las Vegas?
I'll say that again.
How did you, because you moved to L.A., right? From Houston, yeah, you moved to L.A.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we moved to L.A. when I was 9 years old.
And at what point did you move back to Houston?
Well, I came back to Houston. Like I said, I was a freshman in college, and I graduated from high school in 70. And so my grandmother got severely ill, and so I came back here that summer of 71, and she eventually passed. And so while I was here, I said, let me see if I can find the chapter of Black Panther Party. So I was driving down Dowling, and I saw signs that People's Party 2, and they had Panthers on both sides of the sign, you know. So I stopped and went in and talked with the brothers, and we got, you know, sisters. And that's when I joined. I left college after my freshman year.
So
in fact, I went back to I went back to get my student loan money, which was $1,500.
Yeah. I heard that, brother.
And I bought 2 shotguns and 3 M1 carbines.
Yeah.
It came back to Houston.
So how did you make your way to Las Vegas?
Well, one thing, my dad, like I said, my dad moved to Las Vegas in 1968. So what had happened in the party, you know, I had many functions. Like I said, I was 5 years old. I used to be head of photography for the newspaper. And one of the things I used to do is every weekend, I'd take a group of comrades to L.A. or Las Vegas to collect donations. And in 1977, we were ready to go back and expand. Darren Perkins went to East St. Louis, and I came down to Vegas and started chapter there in 77.
In 1977, you also said that Las Vegas is an example of what's wrong in America. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, you know, Vegas is the entertainment capital of the world. I don't care what anybody says, you know. And the thing about capitalism is, you know, it's all about money and about keeping you entertained, to keep you dumbed down to, you know, what's going on. Just like I was talking to somebody yesterday, and that girl was from Baby Man. It's like people watch, what's that show about, this fat white girl and country people. Anyway, anything. I think you might know the show I'm talking about. But people watch that stuff, you know. They keep you dumbed down. And, you know, or like the hip-hop kids of Atlanta, you know.
Yeah, rap gang.
You know, they keep you. So Vegas is, you know, is one thing. It's all about money, and it's all about entertainment. That's where they try to keep you entertain. Or, you know, just like with the things going on now, I mean, 20 straight times, you know, I've never seen anything like it. But I told people, in fact, I mentioned earlier, Kofi, I told him when everything started, I said, they're going to do just like it did after the Watts riots. Because what they did, they dealt with Capitals, they just throw money at the problem, you know, a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
And so during after Watts riots, one thing white folks was like, what the hell? We thought niggas was happy and shit. You know what I mean? What the hell's going on? And so they started throwing money at it. And, you know, he started his economic development programs, and they started this college program. And that's what they're doing now. But see, the money's going to go to people like the NAACP, the Urban League, people that's not on the ground in the community every day working, like mm-hmm. they stretch or other organizations. You know what I'm saying? And so it's not going to work. Unless they come into the community and investigate with who's out here year-round doing stuff in the community with little money. Let's help them out, and they can do more, you know? But just like I saw, you know, shoot, Digiland gave NAACP $2 million, and I don't think they give them, you know, or they go on to Black Lives Matter. And us Black Lives Matter is supposed to not be an organization. It's supposed to not have no, you know what I'm saying? So who are you going to give the money to,
right?
You know?
So what you saying that about the NAACP?
Well, the thing about it, you know, I told some people, crazy, so like, well, the NAACP been around a long time. They knew no, this is not your daddy and your granddaddy's NAACP.
Mm. Okay.
This is not W.D. Bois's NAACP. This is not Thurgood Marshall's NAACP, you know, or even Roy Wilkins' NAACP. Now, you want to find NAACP, you know where you go? You go to one of these banquets or one of these nice hotels or look at the NAACP awards show on. You ain't going to find them in the community, you know? You know, I bet if you went over there on the west side, I'm talking about the real west side. I ain't talking about, you know what I mean?
That's where we at right
now. Yeah, right now.
And ask them who is NAACP, the majority of people would say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not in the community doing anything. You know what I mean? Now, they accept scholarships. Now, yeah, we need scholarships for kids, but goddamn, half them people, not even half, a majority of them, they got money. why don't you just give somebody some money to go to school? You know what I mean? Why don't you do something in the community where it's needed, the people that need it?
So they taking the money, but they're not putting the money back into the community is what you're basically saying.
Right. You know, they had these banquets, they charge $100 a seat or whatever, you know what I mean?
And,
you know, we set up a scholarship for this, and if that's all fine. Good, like I said, we need educated people, but then half the ones getting scholarships is their kids. You know?
Yeah.
Roy, you're shaking the table.
So coming to Las Vegas and starting a chapter, what were the race relations back then in the 60s and 70s?
Oh, man, it's horrible. You know, we used to say, in fact, I put on Stretch Page.
Shout out to my brother Stretch.
That the three M's ran in Las Vegas. The Mormons.
Oh.
The Metro Police and the Mafia.
Yeah.
You know, that's who went in Las Vegas. And see, then back then, I don't know, what's the name of these brothers? These are these brothers. In fact, one of them owned these, it was a store like Kmart, but it wasn't Kmart. One of them ran a business that sold the bar setups, the clubs and stuff. And one of them was the sheriff. I can't remember their names. But yeah, it was straight up racist, and they were Mormons. And so here it is, like, if you come to Vegas, if you wanted to work, well, you had to go through the sheriff to get a work permit.
Mm-hmm. Same way today.
And And then they had a thing where the one that sold stuff to the bars was like, well, you got to go get a permit from the sheriff. So who you go, you know what I'm saying? Who you going to hire to put the stuff in? That, you know, that's guaranteed. He hired his brother, you know? And that was going on back then, you know? And it was very, very, I mean, just like, you know, in the 60s, you couldn't go on the strip for entertainment. You can go out there if you're a porter or a waiter or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't until Ruby Duncan and her welfare rights organization marched on the strip. Very courageous woman marched on the strip. And that's when things changed. Because I remember my dad first moved in 68 over the west side with Slacker. He had casinos, you know.
Yeah.
He had the Cove and, you know, he had casinos on the west side. And somebody burned up the Moulin Rouge after a while, probably with the mafia. But, you know, everything was happening on the west side for blacks. Even the, you know, entertainers that perform on the strip, they couldn't stay on the strip.
Right. Facts.
You know. Sammy Davis, Red Fox, all of them. They couldn't stay on the strip.
Facts. So they came to the West.
You know, like the movie, Dorothy Dandridge's movie, you know, where they had her in a bungalow way in the back and they told her don't get in the swimming pool.
Yeah.
And she jumped in the swimming pool and they drained the whole pool. You know what I mean? Wow. She even poisoned the dad pool. Got that black ass. They drained the whole pool.
Wow.
You know, so yeah, it was very, very racist. This cowboy country, people think about Texas as a cowboy. It's like when I first moved to LA, everybody asked me, well, did you have a horse? You know,
wow.
They think, you know, everything is, you know, but Nevada is very cowboy, very, you know, I mean, things are changing, you know, just like they changed in Texas. Texas is, you know, I say considered a red state, but if you look at it, all your major cities are run by Democrats. But it's the rural areas, there's some country folks, you know, it's just like if you drive out in the country, you see the Confederate flags and all that, you know what I mean? So.
Do you?
But yeah, Vegas was very, 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 very racist. I tell you, I remember getting arrested when I was a part of that. And I'm in the car and these two white cops, so they drive me, I think down Washington or Bonanza, one of them. But anyway, and they talking about how bad we live.
Yeah.
And they like, look at them. See how they live? They ain't, look at them. They trash. They, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm.
And I'm in the back talking shit to them.
Do you, of like in, you know, in Texas and in other places right now, they're like knocking down like Confederate statues and
right.
You can't, the Confederate flag, I think NASCAR, but you know, kind of like who cares,
right.
But you know, right. NASCAR, right. You can't use the Confederate flag no more. How do you feel about that?
It's way overdue. I mean, look, if you go to Germany, you can't display no Nazi stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you go to jail. It's a crime to display any memorabilia of the Nazis. That's a crime. And then here, these were traitors. They were treasonous. And see, the thing about it, most of them statues wasn't put up. They weren't put up right after the war. They were put up in the early 20th century. You know?
Mm.
And yeah, they need to come down. Because the thing about it, no, they tell me, well, you're trying to watch it. No, history needs to be taught.
Yeah.
You know, but we don't need to have no symbols. I mean, you put up a statue to praise somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You know, so we don't need no statues like that. They need to come down.
Yeah. I guess.
You know, children. And then, I don't know if it's still Mississippi or one of them, they still got to be. At the corner of a flag, they still got a Confederate flag up there. What kind of shit is that?
Yeah. I guess my position was, you know, I like to know where I am and where I'm not welcome. I don't know. I don't know where these. I don't know where these statues were in terms of where they were within the state or the city. Like if they were in downtown or somewhere. But I would like to know.
Oh yeah, just like here. The mayor here just ordered. It was one in the big park here. It was Herring Park. It's one of them. He has a couple of them. But a lot of people upset because he's gonna still have them displayed. One of them's going to the African American Museum. And another one's going out to some small town somewhere. But you know, the thing about it, like I said, you don't need to glorify. I mean, yeah, we need to know our history. You don't wipe out history.
You said, hold on, am I mistaken? Are you saying a Confederate statue is going into an African American Museum?
Confederate statues. Well, one of them, I'm going to tell you about Dick Darling. Like I tell you, Emancipation Street. When Carl was assassinated, the street was called Darling. Captain Dick Darling was a Confederate soldier. So Emancipation Park, it's a section with Fort Hood in, but it was called Freedmanstown. And so it wasn't a park for blacks that were in Houston. And so the residents of Freedmanstown got together and they bought like 40 acres. And they created a park. They called it Emancipation Park. So in the white folks, the street going by Emancipation Park, they named it Darling Street, which is for a Confederate captain. It just got changed 2 years ago to Emancipation. But his statues, they had a statue of him in one of the parks, so they taking that down. And I didn't know this. They said the reason, like Juneteenth, that the reason that one of the reasons that blacks here didn't know about the Emancipation Proclamation was because of Dick Darling. Because the unions, it was in the paper today. I didn't even know this. The union sent these troops here, and they would come up to Sabine River. And Dick Darling and his little band of, Confederacy over, but they had these cannons, and they pushed them back. So, because they were coming up to let people know that, hey, y'all free, So that's why it got pushed back 2 years. I mean, it's 2 years after Emancipation that, to tell the truth, finally got here, and,
So what would be, what is the reason a Confederate statue would be put into an African American museum?
Well, they had this brother on radio. He's the head of the museum, and he's talking about it so we can tell the history and stuff. But I don't buy it myself. I mean, everybody got their own opinion about stuff, but it needs to be put in the dark corner in the basement somewhere.
Right. So with you living through so many assassinations by police or assassinations by government, I'd say,
right,
to now where we are seeing these assassinations on social media, on people's phones, they're out in the open. Now you can just Google a name.
Right.
You can Google a name and watch someone get murdered. What is your thoughts on that? Is this the new norm? Is this the new norm? Will we be seeing this time and time again, or at some point will you see it cease to exist?
Well, the thing about it is,
because right now it just seems like it's evolving.
Yeah, and it's just showing what's been going on for years. I mean, it's just like, let's say, back in, like my friend Kofi, I mentioned him a few. I remember before the elections back then, he asked me what time did it remind me of. I told him it reminded me of the late 60s, with Nixon and the party and the whole thing. And I tell you the truth, in a way, I wanted Trump to win because I knew he was going to expose the whole system. Because the thing about him, he don't hold his tongue.
This is true.
He done got them taken off their hoods and, you know, marching with torches and, you know, so I knew he was going to expose the whole system. And the thing about it, like I said, with these cameras, but one of the points I wanted to make, like back in the 60s, or back with all kinds of stuff that, you know, blacks had been complaining about police brutality for years. But it wasn't until them hippies started protesting, they started beating their ass, and all of a sudden it was police brutality. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, or just like with the drug issues, you know. As long as in the, just like the Godfather, you know, the Godfather, well, okay, we can go ahead and do drugs as long as you keep in the Dolphy community, you know what I mean? So, as long as in our community, it's fine. But, you know, when
right.
white folks, then all of a sudden we got a drug problem. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know? So, I mean, the system, I mean, we all know it's a double standard system. The whole justice system is double standard. I mean, just like the sentencing, right? Like, there's so many cases that you got to, you know, a white boy gets probation and a black person gets 10 years, you know, for the same crime.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is exploding. Now, and I think one thing that the pandemic, the corona pandemic, one thing, it exposed capitalism for what it is because it laid everything open. I mean, it's just like exposed the healthcare system and it exposed the system where people are living. You got people living month to month.
Yeah.
And then they ain't got no job and then they getting, you know, it wasn't for understanding where you can't evict nobody, but they can't pay their rent. They can't buy no food. People in long lines. I mean, people that never thought they would have to do it in long lines with the cars to get a box of food to last them 2 or 3 days. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So expose the whole thing. Or just like what Governor Cuomo said early on, he said, we used to get masks for 75 cents. Now they want $7. Mm-hmm. That's capitalism at its finest.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Make that buck.
Supply and demand.
No matter. I thought we all into this together. Mm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We're all supposed to sacrifice. But no, the ones that always have to sacrifice is the working man, the poor man. You know, one of the things that, you know, that I always think about is when, even before the pandemic, I'm just talking when normal economics, I mean, with economy going through, whatever, and the company said, well, you know, sales are slow, we're going to lay off 1,000 workers. Well, how come that billionaire don't say, well, wait a minute, don't lay them people off. Here's $100 million. Mm. You know what I mean? To keep them people working. No, they don't want sacrifice. There's always got to be the person at the bottom.
Yeah.
Rich get richer, you know? Poor get poor.
Yeah, I mean, just like $1 billion. That's a $1,000 million. $1,000 million. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I appreciate you breaking that down in skinny terms.
Yeah, that's $1,000 million. And people don't comment. They just say, "Oh, he's a billionaire." Okay, but what is a billion? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then you got people got $100 billion. You know what I'm saying? That's a problem. I'm gonna tell you about this little quick story right too. Here, me and Eric were hugging when I was in charge of photography for the Panther paper. We were in Oakland, and somebody came by and told us that it was a guy living in a car in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And so me and Erica, we went over there and we looked on him and we found him. Sure enough, it was a black guy living in a Volkswagen. He probably was in his 40s, living in a Volkswagen. We were shocked.
Yeah.
And now you got thousands on the streets. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We were shocked.
Yeah.
This one person was living in a car.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because the gap between the rich and poor, you know, it grows every year, you know.
Yeah.
They pay lip service to it, but come on now.
Yeah.
So, well, so do you feel like at this point that status is more? I don't know how to explain it, but is status more important than race at this point in time? Like, is it still black and white, or is it more so about
it's about class.
Class, yes.
It's by class. I mean, we were, I mean, that's what we talk about. That's our struggle. It's, you know, it's about class. I mean, you know, you got to, it's like the 1%. You know, I was reading an article today, and it was like the 1%. 1% right now has $36 trillion, and that the whole other 90% has $37 trillion. You know what I'm saying? Wow. So that's right. You know, I mean, think about it: $36 trillion and $37 trillion. Well, the 1%. So they almost have an equal amount. I mean, they just a trillion behind. You know, yeah. A trillion is like we just talked about a billion. You know, so you know that's what our whole thing was. It's a class struggle.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, that's what the pandemic showed. That's what I mean. It's a class struggle because I mean, yeah, you got white privilege. A lot of people that got privilege, they admit it, but they may not. They not gonna, what they gonna do about it. I don't know, but yeah, you know, it's like one of my customer's sons. He's a grown man now. Even as a kid, he hated. And he's a white boy. Parents got a little money. He hated poor white trash. You know, he said because if you white, you should be able to make it. You know what I mean? Mm. And this is a kid. That's when he was in high school.
Yeah.
And he told me, man, I hate poor white trash because, you know, if you white, you know, then black people got, I mean, we got to jump through hoops, hurdles, all kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So given all the knowledge you've attained, everything that you've lived through, here and now, what can we do as a community to strengthen it?
Well, for one thing, I mean, what's going on right now? I mean, I got a smile on my face when I just think about these youngsters out in the street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, now how long will it go? But it's going to change. Because like I said, it's a protracted struggle. I mean, people get frustrated. I mean, but we got to use every tool we got. I mean, we got to vote. I mean, that's one part of it. They've always tried to limit the black vote, you know. I mean, you know, back in the day, I remember my grandma used to take me with her to vote when I was, 5-6 years old.
Yeah.
But I remember back then, they had to take a test. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or places had a polling tax, knowing that a lot of people couldn't afford that. You know, so it's always been trying to restrict the black vote. But that's just one element. But we got to stay in the streets. And, you know, and I hate to say it, but, you know, it's going to take some violence. Mm-hmm. You know? It's going to take some people, as you call it, revolutionary suicide, you know, or making a supreme sacrifice.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the only things they understand. Just like I said, just like with the Watch Riots, I was talking about how they was shot. Oh, what the fuck? You know, we thought the niggas was happy. And, you know what I mean? It's just like Ferguson or any other thing that happened. You know, Brother Brown was just a spark. You know, all that stuff was underlying. It's under there.
Yeah.
And then when it happened, they investigated, and they showed how the police department in Ferguson had been targeting black people for revenue. You know what I mean? Tickets and stuff like that. You know.
So, as an elder, you say, you know, you're proud of the youth and what they're able to do right now. A lot of elders do not feel that way, at least the ones I've come across, especially right. In the movement. And it's always been a rocky relationship between our elders and the youth on both sides. Is there any way you see this situation, the climate that we in, being able to mend that or bring us closer together?
Well, you know, you're always going to have, especially in our community, and then you got some people, they call themselves conscious, and I don't know, conscious of what, I don't know, but it don't matter. I mean, the youth are shaking these people up, just like the Black Panther Party did. I mean, think about the party. I mean, we, you know, we lasted, what, 16 years, but they brought everything they had against us. They went all the way to the top, you know? And even back then, you had a lot of the elders from the conservative, even with the sickle cell program. I remember NAACP and everybody, why are you testing? There's no cure. It's not. But the thing was, we could let a person know why they're in pain. Plus, we could tell you, hey, if your husband got sickle cell and you don't, what percentage of chance that your kid might become a carrier or have sickle cell? Or if you were a carrier, and anyway, but, you know, they came out against it. Then a year later, they set up sickle cell foundations. You know what I'm saying? To raise money for sickle cell research, which is a bunch of, you know what I mean? Mm. So the thing about it, you can't worry about what people believe. You have to, because the thing about the party, we didn't just talk the talk, we walked the walk.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? We didn't just say, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. No, we did it. And we were young. I mean, I joined the Black Panther at 19. It's little Bobby Hutton, who was murdered in Oakland at the age of 17, joined the party at 15 years old. Oh. And see, the thing about Huey and Bobby, they had respect. He wanted to join the party. They went to his parents and asked him. And they said, yeah, he can join. Oh. You know? So we were young, you know? And that was another thing. People was like, well, these young folks could do this crap. I shouldn't say crap. They could do this. How come the government can't do it? Mm. You know? But these young people could do this. They could feed kids. They can open up medical clinics. They can test for sickle cell. How come the government can't do it? Mm. You know?
Yeah,
the youth.
No, go ahead.
The youth. I mean, the thing is, they shouldn't care whatever elders are against what they're doing or whatever. They got to do their thing, man, and they're tired. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the thing about it is, and I tell everybody, they're fearless, man.
Yep.
They're fearless. I mean, hell, they surround the police cars with police in them and busting them. You know what I'm saying? With every damn car. they got police abandoning their police stations.
Facts.
You know, this is the second one of what's going on in Seattle right now. You know, they feel this, man, and they're tired. They're tired. Mm. You know? So, yeah, I'm proud of them. I smile every time I think about that. Mm. You know? Because that's where we were. We were fearless. You know? I remember the police chief and the mayor here in Houston called a press conference. And in that press conference, the mayor said that within a year, all members of the Black Panther Party and People's Party II will be dead, in jail, or cease being revolutionaries. And we laughed. This was like, you know what I'm saying? You know, because we were fearless.
Yeah.
You think that made us shirk and go away? No. He just pissed us off, you know.
I want to confirm something with you, just for the sake of you know, our listeners to be able to go back and reference, because you gave us a lot of names and a lot of things for us to go back and research. I want to confirm the sheriff's name in Las Vegas at the time. Are you talking about Ralph Lamb?
And the his Lambs. Brother, it was Floyd Lamb. The Lamb brothers.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
Yeah, I just want our listeners to be able to go back and research.
See, one of them owned these, I don't know if they were grocery store, but I think it was more than a grocery store.
Yeah.
One of them owned a store, and one of them, it was three of them. It was the Lamb brothers, right.
Yeah.
Thank you for the Lamb brothers.
Yeah. Because I remember watching the movie Casino, and it actually had a scene where it pretty much showed what you were saying in that scene as far as how you had to go through the sheriff. You had to get the sheriff's approval for everything back then.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right, yeah. You couldn't work in Las Vegas unless you had a work permit.
Yeah,
it's almost like a part-time actor. That's what I thought about it back then. I said, damn, because you know that's where it was in a part-time actor. You had to get a permit to work. You know what I'm saying?
All right. Again, man, we really, really, really appreciate you. But I have one question, because you've lived a lot. You've done a lot for our community. The black community as a whole, what is your legacy and what would you want your legacy, what would you want included in that?
Well, my legacy is just, I'm a servant of the people, you know, and I'm still am. I mean, that's what, you know, just like all power of the people was a slogan heard around the world, but what we lived about, it says serving the people, body and soul. And so, you know, that's what I am. I mean, it's just like people, it's just like I have Congress here. They say, well, yeah, this is not a district chairman. No, I'm not a district chairman. I'm just a servant of the people.
Yeah.
I'm not chairman of nothing. Because we have alumni association. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No. You know, because I didn't join the party for no glory or no, you know, I joined to serve the people.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what, you know, I like to really remember this. You know, somebody that through their whole life and, you know, it's comrades that, and that's the thing about the party. I mean, just like Bobby Rush is a congressman. I mean, he was the head of the Chicago chapter after Fred Hampton died.
Yeah.
You know, I got comrades as a professors right now in colleges. Hmm. You know, we weren't no bunch of dumb people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we decided to dedicate our life to serving the people. You know, I could have stayed in college and, you know, went on. And in fact, one of my friends that took me to that first meeting, he became CEO of one of the biggest companies in Europe. We still communicate, you know. But that's what I like to, you know, I'm just a servant of people.
Yeah. So for those listening and would like to contact you or follow you, how could they go by doing so?
Okay, well, on Facebook is just John Crear, John J-O-H-N, Crear, C-R-E-A-R.
Okay.
And then my email address is Bunchy, B-U-N-C-H-Y-C, 00, at gmail.com.
All right, fellas, any closing remarks?
We just appreciate it.
We thank you so much. I plan on keeping as much contact with you as I can, and you'll be hearing from us again.
Oh yeah. Okay, brothers. You know, I appreciate y'all. Like I said, if it wasn't for people like you, then everything we did would have been for naught. And it's just like Elaine Brown told me last time she was here. She said, Bunchy, you know, one thing about it, we all going down in history. And so, you know, I appreciate y'all helping us keep the legacy alive.
Right on. Yeah. All power to the people.
All power to the people.
All power to the people, brother.
All right, brother. That was dope, man.
That was really dope.
I fucked with it. Sometimes you just got to sit down and listen.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, this one was needed. Fellas, before we get out of here, any closing remarks? Where can they find y'all at?
Twitter, Instagram, Young Al Bundy, YUNG underscore Al underscore Bundy.
Instagram, SkinnyJunior777.
Fugas from the 7.
As always, man, you can follow me on Twitter at Just Call Me Spence. That's J-U-S. Call Me S-P-E-N-C. Follow the podcast pages on Twitter at Views from the 7. On Instagram at Views from the underscore 7, and on Facebook at Views from the 7. We out. Peace.
Peace.